Good morning, everyone. I am calling to order this meeting of the Tax Committee for Wednesday, April 15th, 2026. First item on our agenda is moving the minutes for April 14th. Mr. Chair, I think you have a motion for
Yes, I do, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes, and after reading through them very thoroughly, I noticed we just need one simple correction. Towards the bottom of the first page, HF2988 in bold letters, just go down below that and says Chair David. We need to put an S on the end of David.
Sounds good to me.
So I would move them as amended.
Chair David has moved the minutes as amended. We're thankful for your careful eagle eye. All those in favor of moving the minutes as amended, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed, nay. Motion carries. The minutes for April, as amended for April 14th, 2026, are adopted. First item on the agenda, we're doing a little bit of a catch-up today because we didn't get to Representative Ray Rauer's bill the other day. So I'm going to move that House File 4234 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. Representative Rauer, thank you for your patience. Welcome back to your bill.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'm so glad to be back at the Tax Committee. And just a little plug again, love to be a member of the committee someday soon. So we do have a technical amendment for this bill. I'm not sure if we want to start with moving that.
Yeah, we have the A1. Do you want me to move that amendment now?
Yeah.
Great. So I'll move the A1 to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion carries, and the bill is in the form the author would like. Representative Ray Rauer, please proceed.
Thank you again, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. So this bill is our tax-exempt bonding bill, and just a little background. Affordable housing is very complex, and most of the projects, in order to get through the finish line, they have to use many different sources of funding. And one piece of that puzzle is that every state gets a set amount of federal tax-exempt bonds. The federal low-income housing tax credit is the main way the federal government funds affordable housing. And federal law dictates how a project becomes eligible for these tax credits. Last year, there was federal legislation, HF1, that lowered the amount of the tax-exempt bonds a project would need in order to be eligible for the tax credits. So this bill aligns us with that federal change. The end result of this is that more projects will get a tax-exempt bond allocation because the pool of money can be spread across more projects, which means, in turn, that more projects will be eligible for the tax credits, and therefore, HF 4234, when enacted, will be able to create and preserve more affordable housing in Minnesota without any additional state funds. And that's why I'm here. I'm a housing committee member. Believe it's very important for us to continue to expand our housing availability. So the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund had discussions with developers in the fall. They believe it's beneficial because ultimately it's better to have more of these affordable housing projects get done. MMB, HFA, and the developers, as mentioned, chairs of our housing committees, both co-chairs, are all in support of the bill, and we have not yet heard of opposition. We believe there is unanimity within the housing community around the benefits of making this change. And I want to thank the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Family Housing Fund for working on this proposal prior to session and aligning all of the various interests around the bill we have in front of us today. So with that, I would appreciate turning over to my testifiers, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Ray Rauer. First up, Andrea Brennan, welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Brennan. I am president and CEO of the Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. I would just like to add a couple of additional points of information to what Representative Ray Rauer shared. One is that nationally, bipartisan estimates of the tax exempt or the tax credit changes in HR 1 could result in the production of an additional 1.2 million housing units across the nation. So this was the inclusion of this low-income housing tax credit provision in HR 1 last summer was really intended to increase the supply of affordable housing nationwide. The other point I just wanted to add is that When we did the stakeholder engagement, we engaged with most of the users of these private activity bonds, developers throughout the state. And two of the things that that they recommended was that one of them is that the changes would not be in effect until January 1 of 2027 to give the industry a little time to adjust to this change. That is currently stated in the bill. And again, because there is a current cap in 474A, and that cap is currently set at 55% of the aggregate basis of the project. That is the cap that's currently under state law, and so this bill would just reduce that cap to be either the greater the greater of 30% or 40% or maximum permanent supportable debt. And so so this change really just does track with what was currently under what is currently under state law in 474A, tracks with the change in HR 1 to allow for the same amount of efficiency in the use of this federal resource that, as Representative Rehauer said, is the primary most prominent source of federal investment in affordable housing nationwide. So now I would like to turn it over to Ms. Tingerthal to give some concrete examples of what this change would accomplish.
Thank you so much for being with us, and apologies for mispronouncing your name, especially since we worked together many years ago, and I feel really bad about it, but I'm really thankful to you. At that time, you were working to build housing for Minnesotans, and you still are, and we thank you for your work. I'll just turn it to the other testifier. Please introduce yourself as you get
yes,
going.
Yes, thank you very much, Madam Chair and Mr. Vice Chair. I am Mary Tingerthal. I served for 8 years as the Commissioner of the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, during which we took up the last set of changes to this particular part of the statute, 474A, to target the resources that are allocated through the language in that section. And it was at that time that we put in place a cap of 55% on the maximum amount of bonds that can be utilized for one of these projects, getting an allocation through the allocation process that's administered by MMB. That 55% cap was set at 5% over the federal cap so that there'd be a little bit of extra room. This time, we have a little more experience with working with these bonds, and so we have this two-part cap, 30%, which is 5% over the new federal cap of 25%, but there are some projects that can utilize more of these bond financing for the permanent loan for these transactions. And so that's the case in which it would bump up to 40% if it was a project of that type. As you heard, we did talk extensively with a variety of developers who have made use of this production over the last several years. I thought it might be interesting to members of the committee to understand what this really means in terms of additional projects in Minnesota. So looking back at the track record, there have historically been projects left on the waiting list. The current year, there were 14 projects on the waiting list, totaling over $260 million worth of bonds that they had requested. So this is a resource that's very much in demand. 15 projects in 2025 received allocations for a total of $340 million. So, you know, two-thirds as much as those that got bonds didn't get bonds. The good news about making this change, which again is not a cost to Minnesota, because the federal law is set up maybe in a little strange way where they do cap the amount of bonds we're allowed to issue, but they don't cap the amount of 4% tax credits that we're allowed to issue once a project has an allocation of those bonds. And so doing the math, this would, in a typical year, increase the number of projects from an average of about 16 to an average of about 25 housing projects, so an increase of 9 projects. And it also means that every year it would bring in, through the sale of the tax credits to investors, approximately an additional $120 million for housing. So we think it makes sense, and we do have a lot of consensus within the industry, so we urge you to take a serious look at this.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 4234? Not seeing any, we'll move to any member discussion. Representative Lee.
Great. Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Representative Rehrauer for continuing to advance this bill. I think we've talked about this before, how we don't have enough housing, whether it's for rental or for, for sale. I'm curious if you can talk a little bit more about maybe like where you think in Minnesota like this could help, or like what we could see if we were to conform to these changes.
Representative Rehrauer or either of the testifiers, please go ahead and answer a question. Thanks.
Sure.
Ms. Brennan.
Madam Chair, Representative Lee, I can say that so this change will apply to the bonds that are allocated by MMB, and it does not make a change to the bonds that are allocated by the entitlement issuers that are defined under 474, and those entitlement issuers include Minneapolis, St. Paul, Dakota County, and Minnesota Housing. And all of those sub-allocator organizations, they are not limited right now under the statute of 474A to the 55% cap. So they have already started reducing the amount of bonds that they are allocating to projects. So the sub-allocators who are, or I'm sorry, the entitlement issuers who are not subject to this this 50, or they've already started doing that. Because MMB is neither an issuer, they are an allocator of these bonds, they are not an issuer, they are not making the decision around the amount of bonds that are needed for feasibility or are actually issued. So that's a long way around to say that statewide, the bonds are allocated from different organizations, and they are used statewide. The majority of the projects that are funded through MMB tend to be in the metro area and Rochester, Duluth, more of the larger sort of centers in Minnesota. But these bonds are used in a significant way also in greater Minnesota throughout communities, and typically those are receive their allocation from Minnesota Housing as an entitlement issuer. And again, Minnesota Housing is already starting to reduce the amount of bonds that they are allocating to each project. They're just able to do that in a more flexible way based on their underwriting, their expertise, and based on the feasibility needs of the project. Did I answer your question?
Yeah. Representative Lee?
Yeah.
Good.
Good. Thanks.
Great. Any further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Rehrauer, any final thoughts for us?
I'd just like to thank the committee for hearing the bill. I think this is a great way to bring more affordable housing to Minnesota. As a member of the Housing Committee, we have a massive shortage of housing, which is driving up costs of all types of housing. But the two areas that we have the biggest shortage are senior housing and affordable housing. And this will help us expand our affordable housing number of units that we have. So it's a great bill. Thank you for hearing it.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much, Representative Rehrauer. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 4234 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill, and it is laid over. Next up, House File 3697 from Vice Chair Norris. As he's moving up to the podium, Vice Chair Norris is going to move that House File 3697 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. Vice Chair Norris, whenever you're ready.
All right. Thank you, Chair Gomez. Members, this bill deals with what happens when Minnesotans overpay on their taxes. It modifies Minnesota law to align with how the federal government and most states handle refund claims. Taxpayers often mistakenly think our refund claim statute here in Minnesota has the same timelines as the federal government. And because of that, they sometimes find themselves barred from receiving refunds that they are otherwise entitled to for overpayment of taxes. The point of this bill is to ensure that the taxpayers pay exactly what they owe, no more and no less. The fiscal note of this bill predicts a small but manageable increase in refund claims and an overall fiscal impact of $0. So why is this bill necessary? Well, one, it helps clear up confusion. Taxpayers, as I said, might be barred from receiving state refunds in which they're entitled to because they assume, well, if the statute or the statute of limitations at the federal level is X, it would be the same here in Minnesota. We're also an outlier here in Minnesota. Most other states have refund provisions similar to those proposed in this bill. And then it's also just a question of fairness. Taxpayers should be able to have overpaid taxes refunded within a specified period after those taxes were erroneously paid. And with that, Chair Gomez, I do have one testifier here to speak more about this bill.
Thank you very much, Representative Norris. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, esteemed members of this committee. My name is Ben Wagner. I'm a tax controversy attorney here in the Twin Cities, and I'm here today as a member of the MSBA tax section. We are asking for this committee's support of House File 3697. As Representative Norris accurately stated, the current statute that House File 3697 aims to address creates a tax trap for the unwary and for the vulnerable. The trap that I see on a monthly basis typically involves a taxpayer who was dealing with some sort of difficult personal situation in their lives, and as a result, they missed the tax order that the Minnesota Department of Revenue issued, assessing them for a liability that they did not owe. Unfortunately, in those situations, the individuals that were assessed those overstated liabilities typically only take action once the Department of Revenue starts to try to collect on that overstated liability. Unfortunately, at that time, usually a year or two later, it's too late. And the overcollected funds that were sort of collected by the Department of Revenue, you're no longer able to get those back. Well, House File 3697 fixes that. And like Representative Norris stated, it then conforms to the federal statute so that just like at the federal statute, you have 2 years from the date of payment to tell the government why the money should not be owed. Ultimately, the current statute really impacts the vulnerable taxpayers. Taxpayers who are sophisticated or, you know, large companies, mid-sized companies have departments and resources to make sure that this sort of thing doesn't happen to them. It's the individuals who are dealing with sort of the messiness of life that end up being impacted by the current statute. One example of that, I worked with an attorney who, when he first engaged my firm, he was 87 years young, and he told me proudly that he had prepared his return for almost 70 years, which is impressive. Unfortunately, that same individual was suffering from pretty severe dementia. And for the most recent 10 years of his life, he actually hadn't filed the tax return, and the department had filed one for him multiple times. And they overstated his liability to the tune of almost $500,000. The department then started collecting on that money and were able to collect something close to almost $300,000 of the $500,000 that was artificially inflated. I got the transcript logs from my conversations, my clients' conversations with the Department of Revenue, and they read like the worst kind of tragedy. Because the patient people at the Department of Revenue, every single time he called, would tell him exactly what he needed to do to fix the problem. But because of his impairment, he was unable to sort of act on the instructions that they gave him. When they finally engaged our firm, we were able to work creatively with the department to get some of the money refunded, but we were not able to refund up to $100,000. Well, this statute that is before you today fixes that. And my client in that situation would have been able to recover all of those funds. And so that's why we're asking for this committee's support, because it will allow taxpayers who are in a vulnerable state to be able to recover the funds that don't belong to the government. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I also, just the term tax controversy attorney, way better than just being called a tax attorney, I have to say. I really always, whenever I hear that, I'm like, oh, a little thrill. Thank you so much for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 3697? Not seeing any. Is there any member discussion on the bill? Chair Davids, I notice this is a Norris Davids bill.
Yes, a very fine piece of legislation. And so I just would like to ask the department if they have any concerns about co-chair Norris and or co-vice chair Norris's and co-chair Davids's bill.
Does the department want to come up? Thank you.
Wow. Oh. What have I done?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members, my name is Madeline Hara. I'm the legislative liaison at the Department of Revenue. To Mr. Chair's question, no concerns on the language. We unfortunately can't give a formal position for the chair's bill with Representative Norris, but we do appreciate the collaboration on the language and any administrative input the department was able to provide. So,
Chair Davids.
Thank you. So for the record, the department does not oppose this bill.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Is there any further discussion to the bill? Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. Well, so I just can't let tax committee go by without saying today is tax day. And so if you have questions, people should call the Department of Revenue. They have really smart people there who can guide you and like how you can, you know, pay your fair share. And so I just want to clarify something that the testifier said. The department does not file your taxes for you, but they do have very smart people that you can call that can tell you how you can do it. And they don't provide tax advice and don't provide legal advice. So I do want to make that clarification.
Thank you so much, Representative Lee. Very good plug for the services at the Department of Revenue. I know every time I've sent a constituent their way, they really do get helped out. And so if it's today's tax day, so if you're freaking out, call the Department of Revenue, please. Any further discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Norris, any final thoughts for us?
Thanks, Chair Gomez, and thanks to Chair Davids for your co-authorship of this bill. I think it's a common sense bill that reduces confusion and increases fairness in our tax system and would encourage the committee to include it in some sort of vehicle moving forward.
Excellent. Thank you so much. With that, Representative Norris renews his motion that House File 3697 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill, and it is laid over. Thank you, Representative Norris. Up next, House File 4738, Representative Keeler. As Representative Keeler comes up, I'm going to move that House File 4738 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Keeler. Please go ahead when you're ready.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and members. This is a really meaningful bill to bring to the tax committee. I just want to say that I serve on human services, I serve on health. In my time here, my first term, I served with you, Chair Gomez, as the chair and vice chair of preventing homelessness. I've also sat in spaces around children, youth, and family. And the reality is sitting at those tables, we as committee members hear the hardest of the hard. We hear individuals show up across the state asking us to help invest in ways to literally save their lives. One of the things that we have worked a lot on in the state of Minnesota is building a robust Safe Harbor program. Safe Harbor is a program and a tool that supports victims of sex trafficking. This is something that I've been working on my 6 years here. It's something that we've been working on as a state for a very long time. We know that many of you have had some sort of connection to Safe Harbor, whether it's been from training, whether it's been from understanding navigation, or more than that, we've done a really great job in the state of Minnesota investing in shelter capacity. The truth is the human services table where we continue to have this conversation is not a revenue generating table. We are given a budget and it's our job to figure out who deserves the haves and have nots at that table. And it's heartbreaking. Representative Norris, I believe, is the only one on this side of the table who serves on human services. And you can vouch for the really hard conversations we have to say no to every single day. It's my job as a legislator to try to get creative on ways that we can support the things that really matter. In Minnesota, I believe, and I think many of us believe, that it is important that we do not overlook the victims of sex trafficking. We do not overlook the victims of sexually exploited youth. And we know that this is a reality in the state of Minnesota. What we have today is a large lineup of testifiers that will help educate you about what we're doing around Safe Harbor, the impacts that we're having, seeing coming down from a federal level, and why we believe that that's just not fair for the state of Minnesota. This is a border-to-border program. We have navigators all across the regions. We know that this is not just a metro issue area. When we've looked at the student survey coming from schools, we know that the largest percent of yes is coming from the northwest corner of the state. So I just don't want us to get caught up in thinking this is a metro-only issue. This is something that we have to do really diligent work for. And I want to remind you guys that we have individuals in the state of Minnesota who are starting to be sex trafficked as early as age 10, 11, and 12. That's not okay. And we have got to get serious about the ways that we continue to fund this. So we're here, Chair, to look at some of the options that we have. And with that, I'll send it over to my testifiers. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeler. First up, we have two testifiers on Zoom. Amber Sadowski.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Representative Davis.
If I could go before you start, I want to have full disclosure here that the funding is coming from a very important bill that I took many years to get passed. And what the bill does is it provides scholarship money for women's sports. So I'm not saying, as the testifiers go, I'm going to be taking very close notes, but I'm not saying this is not a worthy program. I am saying you have the wrong source, funding source, because it's not going to happen. So I don't like providing false hope for people or blowing blue smoke up people's noses when the funding source has to change, because it will not go this way. So I want the testifiers and everyone to know that while I may certainly support the program, I do not support the funding, because I am not going to take money out of women's sports scholarships. I'm not going to do that. So just so you know, we need to look at another funding source, because this one is not going to happen. As you said, you need a creative solution. This is not creative. This is dead. So let's get a different funding source. I'm not taking money out of women's sports at the U to fund this. We have to find a different way. If the committee thinks this is a good thing to do, there has to be another way to do it, because we're not doing it this way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Keeler, do you want me to go to your testifiers?
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Amber Sadowski, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning. I'm Amber Sadowski, and I'm the executive director up at Lighthouse in Duluth. Each year, we serve 800 youth, 80% of whom have experienced homelessness, and together, our Soul House and Northern Lights Safe Harbor programs have served 123 youth, for a total of over 26,000 bed nights. We've also provided 153 Safe Harbor youth with mental health services. For over 10 years, Safe Harbor funds have allowed us to provide compassionate care for youth who carry fear, uncertainty, and the lingering effects of trauma. Highly trained staff and a safe, welcoming environment offer youth a space to heal and thrive. Our Soul House program is one partner in a critical network of providers, and Lifehouse serves youth from our Northeast region and from across the state. In Duluth specifically, we have a history of human trafficking because one aspect of that is that we're an ocean port community. Additionally, according to the 2025 MDH Safe Harbor evaluation to the legislature, the majority of Safe Harbor service users were from Greater Minnesota, and that was 63%. Limited economic opportunity is also a risk factor for exploitation, and in northeastern Minnesota, we face a poverty rate of almost 13%, which is well above the state average. Safe Harbor funds really support safe, compassionate, licensed programs where survivors can live and truly know that they are safe. Your investment in Safe Harbor has been life-changing. 2,000 Safe Harbor youth were served during the two-year evaluation period of the MDH report that I previously mentioned. And I'm also here to advocate for an increase in funding. Rising costs are stretching our resources thin, while the needs are still unfortunately very high, and just program expenses continue to rise while our funding hasn't met those needs. Your support impacts countless young lives and generations beyond. Today, I'm very proud to be testifying alongside Shyla Johnson, who is a Lifehouse alumni and a former Safe Harbor youth. She stayed in our Soul House program for about 2 years, and I'm so proud of her, and I really appreciate her being here today. She's a leader in a local homelessness advocacy group here in Duluth and is an amazing mom to her young son. Shyla is one of over 123 youth that we've had the honor of serving in our Safe Harbor program. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today and to share some data and the impact of our collective work with Safe Harbor.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, James Lewis, Shyla Johnson, also on Zoom. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Hi. Hello, members of the committee. My name is Shyla Johnson. I'm testifying today in support of the bill for Safe Harbor funding. As Amber mentioned, I am a recent alumni youth. I am a mother to my four-year-old son, Amrik, and I am currently a leader in my homelessness advocacy group called Streetwise in Duluth. So being a recent youth at Lifehouse, I used to stay in the Soul House program. I was in there for over 2 years. I was homeless for a little bit of time before I went there. That just happened to be the place where I ended up. While I was in the program, I actually was able to accomplish a lot of things that I didn't think I was going to accomplish as a young adult. I graduated high school while being in the program. I got my first car while I was there. I also met a lot of wonderful youth there that I actually was able to form lasting relationships with. I'm still best friends with somebody there that I still talk to every day. I got my first apartment too. I graduated high school and then I got my first apartment. Soul House actually threw me a graduation party and they helped me get stuff for my new place. So that was really helpful. So they basically helped me get started as a young adult, which meant a lot to me because I was homeless and struggled a lot as a young adult. So having this program there for me was really helpful to jumpstart me as a young adult. The program also provided me with different educational groups. They provided me with a safe place. They provided me with stability that I needed at the time to be able to go out into the world. Lifehouse is like a second family to me. I always consider them as family because that's just what they feel like to me. I don't know if I would be like where I am today without them. They provided me with lots of different opportunities. They thought of me. They've cheered me in the background for all my accomplishments through the way. And I think that every youth would benefit from this program. And now I'm currently in college, fulfilling my Associate of Arts degree online while being a leader in my Streetwise group, while parenting my only son who will be starting preschool this year. I have lots of relationships that I still talk with today with these people at Lifehouse. I know that I can always reach out to them if I need, because I know I felt valued. They made me feel valued when I was in their program. So they are people that I trust, and that's a lot to me. So I think that this funding is very important because it did change my life and provided me with a lot of stuff that I use today with my own child. So I think that this funding should continue. And with that, I will pass it on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate you being here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Up next, James Lewis with the link, and then on deck, Chloe Rosabella. Thank you for joining the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Thank you, Chairs Gomez and Davids. My name is James Lewis. I currently serve as Chief Program Officer with the link. The link is a youth and adult-led nonprofit based in North Minneapolis that provides street outreach, drop-in center, shelter and housing, along with other services for youth and young families experiencing homelessness, sex trafficking, or who are involved in the juvenile non-justice system. I'm also here representing the Youth Services Network, which is a statewide collaborative of homeless youth provider serving agencies across the state of Minnesota. Today, I'm testifying in strong support of House File 4738, which provides much needed additional funding for emergency shelter and housing for children and youth who are victims of sex trafficking. We have made some great progress in the fight against sex trafficking through all of your help with passing the Safe Harbor Law and providing critical resources for shelter, housing, and services for trafficking victims. Thank you so much for that support. I also really want to sincerely thank many of our partners, including local professional sports teams such as the Vikings, Timberwolves, and Lynx, for supporting us in the anti-trafficking movements along with the NFL and the NBA. A key example of this strong support and partnership was when Minneapolis hosted the Super Bowl back in 2018. The NFL invested funding to support us along with our partners, StreetWorks and the Family Partnership, to provide increased street outreach, drop-in center hours, and emergency shelter for victims of sex trafficking, along with having us train their 50,000 Crew 52 volunteers. The NFL also supported an anti-trafficking awareness campaign designed by youth survivors from the link. Although we are grateful for the progress that we have made across the state to fight sex trafficking, we still have so much more work to do. I know that no one wants to think about our children being bought and sold for another person's profit, but it's happening every day all across the state of Minnesota. The 2022 Minnesota Student Survey found that at least 4,800 youth in Minnesota high schools had experienced sexual exploitation. This is absolutely unacceptable and concerning because we know that this is actually an undercount. Unfortunately, the link is unique that we are one of the state's few emergency shelter and housing programs specifically for victims of sex trafficking. This is our Passageways and Emergency Shelter Housing Program. There are only two shelters specifically serving victims of sex trafficking in our state and five housing programs, totaling fewer than 200 emergency beds and housing units combined. We know this is not enough, but are still grateful to have Passageways Shelter and Housing Program. It is literally saving lives on a daily basis. But we do not have enough room for all the trafficking victims who need support. Every month, we turn away at least 16 youth who have been trafficked due to being full, and that equals about 192 victims each year that have been turned away. And right now, currently, we have a wait list of at least 25 victims of sex trafficking waiting to get into our housing program. In addition to our own agency's information, we also know there is a high demand for shelter and housing for sex trafficking victims across the entire state. During the last biennium, 26-27, DHS received $23.3 million in requests for funding for the Safe Harbor Emergency Shelter and Housing RFP, and was only able to award less than half of the requests at about $11.46 million. This funding is extremely critical and needed to support these amazing youth. We appreciate all that you have done in hearing us today, so thank you for your support.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, Chloe Rosabella, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Chairs Gomez and David, for having me here today. My name is Chloe Rosabella, and I am currently a member and co-chair of one of the Link's Youth Advisory Committees, and I also live in one of their housing programs. I personally experienced homelessness and sex trafficking after being kicked out of my family home at age 12, when my very strict religious family found out I was queer. I found myself wandering in the streets for 2 weeks trying to do everything I could do to survive, trying to figure out my next hot meal to eat or my next hot shower to take and my next warm, comfortable bed to sleep on. I stumbled upon a family friend who spotted me on the streets and proceeded to take me under their wing and care, a woman who I thought cared and liked me for who I am. Eventually, she started forcing me to perform sexual favors for men who stopped by on the weekends. They were sometimes physically violent if I didn't do what they wanted. This was a woman I truly thought cared about me and who saw me as a part of her family. But she really, truly only saw me as her asset, her next paycheck, and overall, her property. After being there for 2 months, I couldn't endure her manipulation or any of her abuse any longer. I felt ashamed, disgusted, useless, and weakened by the physical, mental, and emotional pain I went through. I went back wandering through the streets again, trying to survive for the next 3 months. I did what I learned to do when I was first kicked out of my home in order to survive. Picking out food from the garbage, asking people for their leftovers outside of restaurants, or asking for money, even sometimes having to exchange sexual favors for either money or a place to sleep when the offer came. Some days I felt like my life wasn't worth living during those hard, cold, painful months. Eventually I connected with the Lynx Passageways Emergency Shelter, which helped me so much with school, healthcare, supporting me around my goals, and more. The incredible staff of the Link have been there for me during my hard times and traumatic moments. After over half a decade at the shelter program, Passageways, the Link continued working with me and helping me grow into a strong young adult. I have been through a lot and have worked very hard to get to where I am today, which is someone who graduated from high school, has a job, and a goal of becoming a mortician. I am proud how far I've come, but was one of many who needed to have help of an emergency shelter in order to get to where I am today. I strongly urge all of you to support the House File HF 4738. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for being with us, and we really appreciate you sharing your story with us. It means a lot to have you here. Thank you. Up next, Alec Williams, followed by Shunu Shrestha. Excuse me. Welcome to back to the committee, Mr. Williams.
Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, members of the committee, my name is Alec Williams, and I'm a researcher for WEMEC Minnesota, a coalition of labor unions and grassroots organizations advocating for a fair tax code that funds the public services the Minnesotans rely on. Thank you for the opportunity to share a perspective on House File 4738, which ends the sales tax exemption for preferred seating at athletic and entertainment events. We support this policy because it will raise needed revenue in a fair and targeted way and dedicate it to a deeply important public program. Suites are a high-end discretionary purchase. The average cost of a suite to watch the Wolves or Wild is $4,000 to $8,000 per game. Twins games are similar, but can reach $41,000 per game for the largest suites. For a Vikings game, suite costs range from $25,000 to $75,000 per game. Most fans already pay sales tax on tickets and concessions, but our current tax code exempts purchases of suite licenses, premium season ticket packages, and many of the amenities included in those packages. House File 4738 would apply the sales tax to those purchases, closing an exemption that mainly benefits individuals and businesses who can afford to spend thousands of dollars on better seats and a more exclusive experience at sporting events. WEMEC Minnesota generally does not advocate for dedicated revenue, but we are in favor of policies that broaden the sales tax base to fund important public priorities. Just under $9 million annually for the Safe Harbor program is a worthwhile investment in supporting Minnesota's youth who have experienced sexual exploitation. In addition to the moral necessity highlighted by previous testifiers, It is also a highly cost-effective investment. Prior research on trafficking intervention prevention services suggests that every dollar invested yields approximately $34 in societal benefits, reflecting reduced long-term costs in healthcare and other social services. This suggests that the $8.8 million annual investment could result in almost $300 million in benefits. In conclusion, House File 4738 appropriately closes a narrow tax exemption that primarily benefits high-income discretionary spending and redirects those resources towards a program that serves Minnesota's most vulnerable residents. We urge the committee to support House File 4738. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Shunu Shrestha. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Co-Chair Gomez, Co-Chair Davids, and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. My name is Shunu Shrestha, and I serve as the Senior Advisor for the Human Trafficking and Exploitation Prevention Efforts within the Neighborhood Safety Department for the City of Minneapolis. In my role, I work across the city departments and with community partners on issues related to human trafficking and exploitation. Over the past 20 plus years in the field and movement, including 7 plus years with the city, I've seen one pattern continue to emerge. That is, the lack of safe, stable housing significantly increases vulnerability to exploitation and trafficking, and remains one of the most critical barriers to safety. And we see this reflected in the data. Through the city's supported and funded Upside Project in 2022, our partners, the Family Partnership, The Link, Breaking Free, and Minnesota Indian Women's Resource Center reached over 4,300 individuals at risk of or exploitation. When we look at housing status at the time of outreach, 339 individuals were living on the street or in encampments, while only 3 were living in emergency shelter. That gap reflects what we are seeing across the system. And even when outreach and service providers building trust and creating pathways to support, the availability of shelter and housing does not meet those needs. At that point, without a safe place to go, the ability to exit exploitation for many victim survivors becomes significantly more difficult. At the same time, we also see what is possible when stability and support are available. Among individuals engaged in ongoing services through this program, 60% showed improvement in their stability and well-being over time. That tells us that when people have access to consistent support and housing, they move towards safety, healing, and recovery. I also do want to note that this is a year-round issue. Trafficking and exploitation are not confined to a single event. While large-scale events may increase visibility or place additional pressure on systems, they do not create the underlying need. What those moments can offer, however, is a clear example of what a coordinated response can look like. During Super Bowl League, partners across systems, law enforcement, service providers, outreach teams, and community organizations such as The Link, the Family Partnership, and StreetWorks worked very closely together to expand outreach, increase services, and strengthen coordination on the ground. That level of alignment and investment made a significant difference in how the systems responded then. And that is the kind of coordinated, well-resourced response is what we need, not just during major sporting events, but every day. Because ultimately, what those moments reveal is whether our systems have the capacity to respond and whether that capacity exists when it's needed most. From the city's perspective, that capacity, particularly in shelter and housing, remains significantly underfunded and insufficient, making safe harbors, shelter, and housing a critical part of the response. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 4738? All right, not seeing any. We will move to member discussion. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for carrying this bill. And with all respect to Chair Davis, I know that you totally value these services that are being provided, but I think that, and to go to Representative Keeler, this group does not have a lobbyist. She has been champion, and many of these groups that don't have the big money to come up here and talk to us and do things like this, and so I really got to hand it to her and her work that she's done up here for champion issues that don't are underserved communities. But if we don't have this, then where can we find it? Can we raise this tax another 3% to cover some services like this? This is one of those things that we all look back and say it's working. We heard from the testifier in Duluth, who was totally amazing. We all know that we have to break the circuit, and she's doing exactly that with the help of this community. And she's talking about the values she's putting into her own child right now, and it makes me tear up when I hear that, you know, that's where good parenting is, right there, is breaking the circuit. And to the young lady that wants to go in the funeral industry, get a hold of my office. I have some mentors for you. So I just wanted to make the statement. I hope there's a way we can find, if not this, then what? I'm sure there's some place we could find this, because this is really important, and thank you, Representative Keeler, for championing projects like this.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. We'll hook you up on the mortician science front. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep. Keeler, for this bill, and an even greater thanks to those who testified and shared their stories. I have a clarifying question. This might be for Rep. Keeler. Maybe this is someone from the department. There was mention of a shortfall of funds for this program. What is the current, demand is sort of a weird question for this sort of program, but what funding is this looking for based just on current requests?
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and Davids, and thank you so much, Representative Keeler, for bringing this forward. My name is Beth Holger. I'm the CEO of The Link, and I'm also part of the YSN. And what I will say is that the need is incredibly high. Right now, we have 11 million that's allocated over 2 years for Safe Harbor Emergency Shelter at the state level. The Link, along with many of our other partners, has received federal cuts this year from the Federal Department of Public Safety Office of Victims of Crime for our sex trafficking services. So we have lost $500,000, and we are struggling to figure out what to do, as well as other partner organizations as well. So we are facing shortfalls from the federal government, along with the already unmet need that we spoke to. We're turning away nearly 200 youth a year from our shelter. And we currently have 25 victims of sex trafficking on our wait list, and it's heartbreaking to turn them away. So we're one agency that can speak to that.
Thank you. Representative Smith.
I really appreciate that. And the reason I asked the question is from the fiscal note here, the fund impact, we see that this is about $8 million to $9 million a year. And we talk a lot about budgets being moral documents, and Rep. Keeler, I think you've brought like a perfect example of that, where we have folks who life has been very kind to, not just that they can go see live sporting events, but that they're able to afford to see it in very nice suites and pay for the license to continue to have those nice seats and enjoy that. And there's no begrudging them that. I love going seeing live sports, but paying sales tax on that means that folks like we have heard from today get the help that they need when life has been unkind to them and find themselves in some of the most difficult situations we find. These are tax questions, but they're also moral questions. And so thank you for bringing that forward. This might be for nonpartisan or for Chair David. To your question, objection earlier, I believe is the repeal on subdivision 38. Non-partisan, do we know like what percentage of this overall $8 million figure is specifically for collegiate sports?
Ms. Templin.
Madam Chair and Representative Smith, I did anticipate this question, and I did reach out to the Department of Revenue to ask for a breakdown of the general fund impact of the different repeals. There's a suite license repeal, the collegiate seating repeal, and the amenities repeal. Approximately 85% of the revenue gain would be from the suites repeal, 10% would be from collegiate seats, and 5% from amenities, and that's a rough estimate.
Representative Smith?
And the motion is to lay this over, correct, for possible inclusion?
Yes, Ms. Representative Smith.
I might just say, in the interest of, I think, a good bill going forward, with that, knowing that 10% is only on that subdivision 38, potentially striking that provision, Chair Davids, I'm sure we can talk about this, so it doesn't touch on that scholarship funding at all, and yet still gives Safe Harbor grants at least something to fill up that federal funding that is lost. I think that's hopefully something that we can do if we have a tax bill. So it's a great bill. Thank you very much, Representative Keeler, for bringing this. And again, those who spoke and shared their stories, it is not easy to do so here, and we truly thank you.
Thank you, Representative Smith. We have a couple more members. I just was going to ask nonpartisan, as long as we were kind of digging into this appendix to the bill here. Do we have any information about that? We talked about scholarships for women's sports. It says for these they're the licenses, right, to buy the season tickets. It's not the tickets themselves. As long as it's used entirely to support student scholarships, wellness, and academic costs, which are three very different things. And if you're talking about putting them into academic costs, I know that there are now students at the U are being charged a fee related to supporting college sports, which so we're sort of doing a little bit of money moving around. But I wonder if there's any information that we have about that breakdown at all. I know I didn't ask you to prepare this, Ms. Templin, so maybe this is going beyond your what you have access to.
Madam Chair, unfortunately, I do not have the granular detail, but it is something I can look into.
Thank you. Is there anybody present from the University of Minnesota who can address the breakdown of these functions, student scholarships, wellness, and academic costs, and then particularly because we heard about scholarships for women's sports, what the percentage of and the dollar amounts are there. Anyone present? Seeing some movement. Hi, welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself for the record as you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Travis Cameron. I'm with the University of Minnesota Athletic Department. The way we allocate these funds associated with ticket purchases go directly to a scholarship seating scholarship fund. So the funds can only be used for scholarships. I understand that's how the bill was written, but how they are allocated with ticket purchases is directly towards scholarships.
Thank you. Just since the women's sports was specifically mentioned, can you tell us how much of that goes to women's sports?
I can, with a few minutes, I can calculate that for you. What I can tell you is of the distribution, football is obviously a men's sport, so just in light of time, accounts for approximately maybe it'd be best appropriate if I just calculated those for you quickly.
All right, sounds
good.
Is
that okay, madam?
Yep.
Thank you.
We would love to just get you back up here if you can come up with the numbers. We appreciate it. Thank you. Okay, apologies. I just thought as long as we were talking about those fiscal issues, we should deal with them. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Keeler, for bringing this bill. And to all of your testifiers, it was very impactful. And to the young lady who is interested in going into the funeral business, my dad was a mortician as well. And I know you will have a compassionate heart for families in need. So I just wanted to talk about the funding source, because my understanding is most of your current funding for these programs out of DHS?
Representative Keeler or Ms. Holger?
Yeah, so in the past, it's kind of been a partnership between DHS and Department of Health, because there's a navigator system here, too, so it's been an overlap. Again, the reason why we're here is because when we sit in Human Services, we just get a budget that's sent to us, and then we're already very underfunded on all the services that we have to provide. And so, yes, at this point, a majority of the shelter capacity and the navigation systems are through DHS and Department of Health.
Yeah, so this is funded by general fund dollars, which are also general fund dollars here from this funding source. Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Chair Gomez. So I would just like to suggest that we close the housing stabilization program, which was rife with fraud, $100 million a year. And the governor's proposal is to try to reconstitute that program. I don't think we need the housing stabilization program. It was a failure. And rather than reconstitute
Representative
that.
Representative Robbins, it's not actually a tax provision. I'll let you finish,
right.
But let's
yeah,
let's
rather
finish
than reconstitute that, I think we should try and get the money that's somewhere in the ether in the DHS budget for housing stabilization.
Thank you, Representative Robbins.
And use it
Robbins.
For this. So I encourage you to talk with them about that, because I think there is money out there that hasn't. Since we closed the program, I don't know what happened to that budget.
Representative Robbins, thank you. Please conclude your
okay,
your
I am trying to provide a helpful suggestion, Madam Chair. I do think there's money sort of left on the table from the closure of housing stabilization
thank
that
you.
We could repurpose.
Thank you. Yeah. Representative Keeler is the vice chair of the Human Services Committee, and so I know that she sits in those spaces two or three times a week, and I'm sure knows that in
three
and out.
Three times, 8:15.
Three times a week, 8:15 a.m. if anybody's counting. Thank you, Representative Robbins. Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair, and to Representative Keeler, I just want to say to you, first of all, miigwech to the work that you're doing, and this is one of the issues that you and I both know drove us to the Capitol and on a mission to end violence because it's at the root of so many issues impacting our communities. And I just want to say miigwech to you for being a freaking legend. I think I just kind of want to level set and bring us back, as I feel like I often do in this committee, to what we're really doing in the heart of this bill. And as somebody who's played sports growing up, basketball and broomball and hockey and soccer, know that sports is really magical and it can bring people together in so many beautiful ways, especially for our young people, but that there is a reality that's a shadowy side that's tearing apart communities and lives. And we know that human trafficking, whether that's sex trafficking, labor, that also has lots of ripples of domestic violence, happens in and around and through sports. And to everybody who is out there listening and in these rooms, we often talk about how our communities are vulnerable, but we're not vulnerable, we're preyed upon. Mm-hmm. And trafficking cuts across every single committee, and so I appreciate the conversation we're having about what budget, what funding mechanism this should come from or what it shouldn't come from. But in the same way, when we talk about housing, every committee should be working on that. You know, this is housing, public safety, human services, on and on. And we know our funding comes in pieces, but our people don't. And it was brought up here of the word demand. And that is uncomfortable to say, Representative Smith, because the reality is that just yesterday it was Missing Murdered Black Relatives Day on the Hill. And it's, you know, every month I serve, we have a Missing Murdered Indigenous Relatives. We have the task force and the work, and I have personally led on the anti-violence against Latine relatives. But the word demand is literally in every report we've done. Demand for sex and violence. There is a demand for sex and violence of our women, girls, our two-spirits, and our relatives, and even our young boys. Internet, extractive industries, entertainment, hotels, and sporting events are on the list of systemic things we must invest in and end in Minnesota. The reality is that we see it intensify, and this is a $150 billion industry. Human trafficking, sex trafficking is a $150 billion industry. We see it in NCAA basketball tourneys, Olympics, World Cups, Super Bowl, concerts, and conventions. And it doesn't just happen on the biggest stages. We have it right here in our own backyards. And even, frankly, legislators, we must face it, that it's under our dome with legislators committed, charged with sex trafficking rings. And so what I want to lift up today is what we've heard from the work of the successes of what we're investing in into our Lifehouse and Streetwise in Duluth that talks about what we're seeing is also increased enforcement and reporting, and that is a good thing. And that with Lifehouse and Shy, who this is a really important, amazing, glowing young person in my community. I personally know her and have seen the work that she's doing and the work that Safe Harbor does to make sure that we're treating people as human beings and victims and not criminals. But I want to say to you that you're not just victims, that you're born survivors and that you are legacy makers, like our testifier here, who is, we've talked about going on to become a mortician. In my community, we call people deadly as a praise. And so I look forward to you going into that career as well. But I want to bring us back and just close with saying that, you know, Chair Davids, I have a lot of respect for you. And the work that we've done here, and I think that the way that Representative Keeler and these testifiers and every survivor around the state was just told no. The thing is that the number one thing you can't tell a Native person or a survivor is no, because we hear that every single day. But we owe you a debt of gratitude, and that this is a small price to pay, and no matter how we can figure out the funding, that it's worth it to actually protect our women, girls, our boys, and our relatives. But I can't sit here and feel the contempt that we have for people of color and for women and survivors coming before us. And the first thing that they hear out of the gate is this isn't happening. Mm-hmm. This is, because we need to wake up and understand that this is happening to us every single day, every single day. And so this committee owes Representative Keeler and every single survivor an apology, and we can do that best by making sure that we're funding this going forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Kozlowski. Representative Joachim? Oh, are you?
Thank you, Madam Chair, but I think Representative Kozlowski said it all.
Thank you. Is there any further member discussion before we go to Chair Davids? All right. I just also want to, before we go to Chair Davids, have a last word before the author, to thank Representative Keeler. Just during her time here, during your time here, you have been laser focused on making sure that people have a dignified place to lay their head at night, that people have food in their bellies, and that sex trafficking victims have the services and the support that they need to restabilize their lives. And it has just been a through line in your time here. And it's something that you have made all of those issues. I know that you care about a lot of other stuff and you work on a lot of other things, but your impact on those issues will be felt across the state for generations. And so we thank you for that. I just will say, every decision that we make around these tables is about trade-offs. Every time we spend a dollar on something, we're not spending a dollar on something else. And so when we have members of our community, Minnesotans, coming and telling us, you know, I've had a really rough go of it and I need some help from this system in order, you know, to get my life to where it needs to be so that I can be a, you know, full and contributing member of my community, and we are presented a way to pay for it, which repeals mostly 85% of this money, is a sales tax exemption on college or on stadium suites. Millions and millions and millions of dollars going out, not to scholarships for women's sports, not to wellness or academic costs. That's way less than 10% of this, but going to the people purchasing stadium suites. They get $8 million out of the state every year. $8 million that could be going to support sex trafficking victims, and we thank Representative Keeler for bringing this forward and highlighting that every decision we make is about trade-offs and that we show who we're here to fight for in those decisions every single day. Thank you. Chair Davids.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair, and I wish members were listening a little bit closer to what I said. I have no problem with what the base bill does, but the funding is not going to happen this way. Was I clear on that? I thought it was very clear. Nothing wrong with the bill itself. It's the funding. We're not going to fund it this way. Just being up front, we spend way too much time on a bill that's not going to be funded this way. This is so sad. Why is this bill not in Health and Human Services? You get nothing and never have received anything from the Tax Committee. I'm going to go talk to Speaker's office and ask the Speaker, why was this sent to taxes? This is clearly an HHS bill. It's clearly a housing bill. It is not a tax bill. Why, you know, all the stuff is Health and Human Services. Why are you in Tax Committee? So I'll have that discussion myself with the Speaker. The link is not funded from the tax. I mean, none of these groups are. Not one dime comes from taxes. This bill is not a tax bill. I can't stand getting people's hopes up and then not following through. That's just wrong to do this to people. So wrong. So this is not a whole lot of money. A lot of other funding mechanisms. This bill doesn't belong here. I love this place so much because we have a bill here that takes money away from sports teams that are funding their programs. I've never seen that before. One of the testifiers said they get money from the Vikings and whoever else. So you're getting money from these groups and then you're taking their money. That's a first for me, and I've only been here a few years. You know, I was born on a day, but it won yesterday. And to take money from a group that is supporting you is just ungentlemanly, I would say. So again, testifiers, go to the right committee. Go to the right committee. You're not in the right committee. And I'll have that discussion with the Speaker. With the last 4 or 5 weeks here, members, you're going to be hearing this a lot from me. Does the bill bring us closer to resolution or put us further away? This one puts us way further away. We need to work on bills that bring us closer together. Representative Keeler, your bill itself, fine. You got to find a different funding mechanism. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Keeler.
Thank you for the conversation. From my understanding, actually, all the budgets come from taxes, so this is absolutely a place to be. I want to say I've been having a lot of conversations in the communities about taxes. I've never sat on taxes, and so I got the tax expenditure book, which I encourage all of you in Minnesota to look at. It is a book about this thick that talks about all of the tax giveaways that we give to millionaires and billionaires for entertainment. And so this is why we're here, right? Because the reality is when I talk to everyday Minnesotans, I use the example, if we go to a football game and we're regular, degular Minnesotans and we go watch our Vikings, we pay a tax on our regular seat. You know who doesn't pay a tax? Millionaires, corporate entities that are deciding to entertain themselves. 85% of this is for the suites for that. So what we're saying is that if we captured that tax from millionaires on their entertainment and sent it over to Safe Harbor, that would be a good thing for us to do. We see this deflection all the time. It's nothing new that a white man's going to yell around in the corner about sex trafficking and violence against victims. It's not new to us. I think Representative Kozlowski said it very well. It was really disheartening that we come here because we have tried every angle in the human services. And I really hope you follow up with Speaker Damon. I'll join you in making sure that we get more money then in our human services budget when we are always on the shortfall of things, that we have to get creative to go outside of our own committee lane to try to get creative. I don't know if you've ever experienced working with a youth who has been sex trafficked, who grown men, some of which have traveled here to do their job and have been busted, some of which who have gone in 2023, we had an individual who was sentenced to 21 years because they ran the largest sex trafficking ring in this state, and a lot of that money that was earned, where was that put? Into political pockets. So we know that there is an overlap. It's not a surprise that we're going to deflect talking about women's sports. You never came even back up to tell us how much of the percent went to women's sports to justify what they were talking about. We tried to yell around about fraud because that's another tactic that we use to move away from the reality of the fact that individuals individuals in this state and in this nation believe that it is okay for adults to buy children to have sexual intercourse with them, and we are saying it's not okay. We are getting creative. We are going outside of the lanes of opportunity because I am telling you, Human Services does not have the money to see what is happening on the shortfall. These individuals, our youth, deserves for other tables to get brave enough to think of ways that they can support all of us. This is a true and honest way. This isn't a gimmick. This isn't take me back to my committee. I am here at the tax table to start thinking about a new way. And I hope other people find this as an example of ways that we can go find other money. We give away millions and billions of dollars to millionaires to entertain themselves in this state while we are suffering and we need to support our youth. Thank you for the honest consideration. Thank you for those of you who actually listen to the testifiers and the stories. This is heartbreaking. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I will renew my motion that House File 4738 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill, and it is laid over. Thank you to everybody who came to testify on the bill. We really appreciate it. Up next, Representative Greenman has House File 1183. While Representative Greenman's approaching the podium, the chair will move that House File 1183 be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill. Representative Greenman, to your bill. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's nice to be here. And I am glad that there's some interest in talking about fraud, because today we're going to talk about misclassification fraud. What House File 1183 does is it is a bill, it is a simple bill, that says Minnesota will no longer conform with Section 530 of the IRS code, which means that Minnesota will no longer implement the federal tax provision that gets a permanent tax haven for employers who've been found to misclassify their employees as independent contractors. And for folks who are unfamiliar with this Section 530, it involves places where either the IRS or the Department of Revenue have determined that an employer taxpayer has illegally misclassified a worker under the IRS test. When an entity commits misclassification fraud, it cheats workers out of pay, out of overtime, and worker protections. And it also steals from the taxpayers and public programs by defrauding the UI Trust Fund, tax revenues, the Workforce Development Fund, and other programs that rely on those employment taxes. In fact, the OLA 2024 report on misclassification found that in addition to its impact on workers, misclassification affects state and federal tax finances through, quote, lower program and tax revenues for increased reliance on government services. In 2025, and you're going to hear from a second from North Star Policy Institute, they estimated that misclassification fraud cost the Minnesota state government between $506 million and $1.3 billion, which includes unrealized state income taxes, payment into unemployment trust fund, and workers' compensation premiums. Over the last 3 years, we've advanced policy in other committees to strengthen enforcement and improve coordination amongst agencies in taking on misclassification fraud. In 2023, we created the Intergovernmental Misclassification Enforcement and Education Partnership to bring together all the enforcement entities with a single goal of effectively reducing misclassification fraud through the strategic deterrence, enforcement, and education. This whole of government approach is really important, but Minnesota's Section 530 safe haven remains an obstacle to effective strategic enforcement for those who break the law and rip off the state. What Section 530 does is it relieves an employers who commit misclassification fraud of their employment tax obligations, and it allows, going forward, those employers to continue to misclassify their workers if they've consistently done it and have a reasonable basis for doing it. And a reasonable basis by courts and federal agencies has been very liberally construed. It includes a narrow provision about Fed prior audits or judicial precedents, but most importantly for our purposes, it also includes industry practices and an other reasonable basis that is liberally applied. This isn't just a one-time safe haven for repaying federal taxes. It's a quote-unquote permanent cure that allows employers to continue misclassifying those workers for the purposes of employment tax obligations. And lest you want to defend this, the safe harbor does not extend to workers. It only is a safe harbor for the employer's tax issues. I actually learned about Section 530 while I was co-chairing the Attorney General's Task Force on Misclassification, and it came up as a legal barrier to effective whole-of-government investigations and enforcement in the industries where we are seeing it has become an industry practice. Many of the tax implications of Section 530 are at the federal level, but providing this safe haven at the state level has an impact on Department of Revenue's ability to track and enforce misclassification. It, again, as I said, and you're going to hear about the construction industry in a second, it specifically deals with and makes it hard in places where there is an industry practice of misclassification. It hinders a tax auditor's ability to detect, investigate, and enforce rampant issues of misclassification fraud. And it makes it harder for us to go after that business model of fraud. And it's important, and this is really important from the history of this provision, Section 530 is not a Minnesota law. This provision was adopted by Congress in 1979 as a one-year temporary tax safe haven corresponding with a very specific set of changes in federal employment law. Then it was extended for 2 years. And then it was made permanent as part of a larger tax overhaul. It didn't become codified in Minnesota law until 2009, when the provision was incorporated in a Minnesota law, broadening the definition of the IRS section 290.19 to include any codified provisions in federal law. It was not an intentional decision by this committee. And so when you hear businesses' interests, which I think you probably will, who benefit from this tax haven, keep in mind that this committee probably hears a lot from people who benefit from a tax expenditure, who benefit from a tax haven, and it is in their best interest to keep it. But this was not a policy decision that we made at the state level. And frankly, it was the federal policy decision was a 1 to 2 year provision that was because of lobbyists and special interests extended. It may be in their best interest, but it is not in the best interest of the state that is losing tax revenue and, more importantly, losing an important strategic way to go after some of these provisions. So as we work together across these agencies and across our committees to both stand up for workers, stand up for high road businesses, and importantly, fight fraud that cheats our Minnesotans who rely on public programs and taxpayers who pay for them, removing Section 530, this safe haven is a very important and relevant piece of this work. So with that, Madam Chair, I will turn it over to some of our testifiers.
Thank you very much, Representative Greenman, for the explanation. I neglected to do your author's amendment, so I just want to move that now. It's titled A1. I'm going to move the A1 so that it's the bills in the form the author would like. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? No. Motion prevails. The bill is in the shape the author would like, and with that, we will move to testimony. So first up, I have Bert Johnson, and then on deck is Dalton Danielson. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Hi. Thank you, co-chairs, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Bert Johnson. I'm general counsel of the Northern Midwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I'm based here in Minnesota, and I have the responsibility of negotiating collective bargaining agreements with employers in various sectors of the construction industry, from highway to bridge construction to commercial to multifamily residential. In our industry, employers that we negotiate with are not our adversaries. They're our partners. When they succeed, our members work. They work more hours, they use their skills to build and earn middle-class wages and benefits for themselves and their families. Minnesota is unique in the multifamily construction industry. We have around 1,000 members that work as members of the Carpenters Union in this sector of the economy. And we have employers that have made a commitment, Minnesota-based employers, that have made a commitment to the skills and productivity of our Minnesota-based workforce. A 2021 study by the Midwest Economic Policy Institute estimates that 23% of Minnesota's construction workforce is misclassified, and that's very relevant based on what Representative Greenman just talked about in terms of how misclassification is common within an industry. This leads to a reduction in income of $29,700 per employee per year and a reduction in tax revenue of an estimated $136 million per year. In Minnesota, we have a rigorous 14-factor test to determine whether a construction worker is truly an independent contractor. We've allocated millions of dollars to investigate civil and criminal aspects of misclassification fraud, wage theft, workers' compensation premium fraud, and even labor trafficking. In one investigation performed by the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's fraud unit, according to the criminal complaint, a business owner literally in their office place filed and set up a dummy corporation for an employee explicitly so the company owner and employee could avoid paying payroll taxes. The employer was later convicted thanks to the hard work of the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's fraud unit and their great law enforcement officers. Even this employer, because 23% estimated of the construction industry is misclassified, could enjoy the benefit of the tax saving created by Section 530 compliance at the state level. HF 1183 would simply close the loophole that allows employers to use misclassification fraud business model to avoid paying payroll taxes. Let me leave the committee with these questions. Does it make sense to maintain a policy in Minnesota of giving safe harbor to employers who are cheating the state, their workforce, and their competitors by fraudulently misclassifying their workforce simply because, as Section 530 explicitly permits, there's a long-standing recognized practice of this type of fraud in the construction industry? Why would we crack down on fraudsters in the construction industry, spend millions of dollars on civil and criminal enforcement, and simultaneously give those same employers the benefit of a safe harbor from payroll taxes? Shouldn't we align our tax code with the important anti-fraud work that the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's fraud unit is doing? For these reasons, then, on behalf of an industry where competition with fraudulent model happens every single day, where middle-class, hardworking Minnesotans and business owners' livelihood is at stake, I urge you to support HF 1183. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Up next, Dalton Danielson, and then on deck, John Besche. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself as you get started.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dalton Danielson, Fiscal Policy Director with the Minnesota Business Partnership. We are here today to oppose House File 1183, which would make Section 530 relief inapplicable for Minnesota tax purposes. While House File 1183 may be framed as a technical tax change, it would have real and meaningful consequences for Minnesota employers. The federal provision targeted by this bill, commonly referred to as Section 530, has for decades provided stability and certainty for employers that make good faith worker classification decisions under complex and often ambiguous rules. This is not cheating the system. House File 1183 would remove that longstanding federal protection at the state level, effectively creating a separate and more restrictive Minnesota standard, even when an employer is compliant under federal law. That divergence matters. It increases compliance risk, invites retroactive reclassification disputes, and exposes employers to unexpected tax liabilities, despite having relied on settled federal guidance. From a competitiveness standpoint, this is especially concerning. Employers often make location and expansion decisions based on predictability. When Minnesota departs from federal tax treatment in narrow but consequential ways, it sends a signal that the state is willing to change the rules midstream, undermining confidence and discouraging investment. Finally, it is important to note that Section 530 already has meaningful protections for workers. Relief is available only when an employer meets strict requirements, including consistent tax reporting, consistent treatment of similarly situated workers, and a reasonable basis grounded in law, prior IRS guidance, and a long-standing industry practice. If those standards are not met, Section 530 does not apply, and the IRS retains full authority to reclassify workers and assess employment taxes. In short, Section 530 is a narrow, good faith protection, not a loophole, and it does not shield intentional misclassification. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Up next, John Besche, and then Jake Schwitzer is on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Please introduce yourself for the record as you get started.
Good morning, Chair Gomez, Chair Davids, and members of the committee. My name is John Besci. I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to provide comments today. NFIB opposes House File 1183, which would remove a longstanding protection for small business owners who have acted in good faith regarding their classification of workers. Section 530 was adopted decades ago to protect owners who work with independent contractors from shifting interpretations by the IRS and courts, and Minnesota has followed this safe harbor. The safe harbor under Section 530 applies only when the following conditions are met. The business must have filed the required information returns consistent with its treatment of workers in a timely manner. The business must have been consistent in how they've treated workers in substantially similar positions. And the business must have relied on, or must have reasonably relied on, either a prior audit, judicial precedent, or longstanding industry practice in a significant segment of the industry. The burden of proof lies with the taxpaying business to establish that it was not reasonable to treat an employee or an individual as an employee. And the taxpayer must also cooperate fully with reasonable requests from the examiner. Under House File 1183, we are concerned that a small business could be held liable for state employment taxes, even though a previous audit had found no issues with the worker's classification. As an example, a business could classify a worker as an independent contractor in year one. In year two, the IRS conducts a worker classification audit and finds no issues. In year five, a new audit is conducted that changes or conflicts with an earlier interpretation. Section 530 could provide some relief for that business if all three conditions are met. For small businesses that have acted reasonably in good faith by relying on a past audit, a court case, or a longstanding industry practice, we recommend keeping this safe harbor in place. Thank you again for the opportunity to provide comment. We respectfully ask the committee to oppose House File 1183. Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Up next, Jake Schwitzer. Please introduce yourself as you get started with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gomez, co-chair Gomez, co-chair Davids, and members of the committee. My name is Jake Schweitzer, and I am the executive director at North Star Policy Action. We're a think tank dedicated to improving the lives of working Minnesotans. And I'm here today to talk about fraud, a crime that's getting a lot of attention in the Capitol. The fraud we're focused on today costs working Minnesotans and the state government billions of dollars every year. In September of 2024, we undertook the first effort to estimate both the scale and cost of worker misclassification fraud in Minnesota. Our research found that nearly 10% of Minnesota's private sector workforce, representing over 300,000 workers, experienced misclassification fraud in 2019. We estimate that workers lost between $2.9 and $6.2 billion in compensation due to misclassification fraud in 2019. Adjusted for inflation, that would suggest that workers today are failing to receive over $8 billion each year, coming in the form of lost paid leave, overtime pay, and health and retirement benefits. Beyond harm to workers, we also know that misclassification fraud comes with an enormous cost to state government, as fraudulent employers avoid contributing to programs that they would be required if they correctly classified their workers as employees. We estimate that the state of Minnesota lost out on up to $1.3 billion in revenue due to a lack of income tax collection, unemployment insurance contributions, and workers' compensation premiums. Ultimately, it is Minnesota taxpayers who eat that cost, forced to plug the gaps created by misclassification fraud. We believe that as large as these losses are, they likely represent a conservative estimate of the damage being done. For example, our analysis did not include losses due to workers being paid off the books in cash. We also did not consider revenue hits to other state programs that rely on payroll taxes, such as paid family and medical leave and the Workforce Development Fund. Our research clearly demonstrates the enormous scale of the worker misclassification problem. We need more tools to address this massive crime. Conforming with Section 530 makes it easier to hide these crimes. Ending that conformity won't solve the problem overnight, but it will make it easier for our overworked law enforcement to do their job and fight the theft of billions of dollars from working Minnesotans and our state government. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Schweitzer, for your testimony. Is there anyone else present who wishes to testify on House File 1183? Not seeing any, we'll move to member discussion. Sorry. What? Oh, we'll do that. Is there any member discussion on this bill?
how times change. I feel like we had a really robust, as we say around here, discussion about this last time that we heard the bill.
We're worn out.
All right. Hopefully you'll get a second wind around 12:15 p.m. Does the department have any comment on this bill? Oh, Ms. Bears, you're back. Excellent. Okay, they're okay. Not at this time. All right, wonderful. Chair Davis, you got anything? No, just on this bill. Okay. All right, Representative Greenman, any final thoughts?
I appreciate that. And I do, this is, as the chair mentioned, this is a bill that we discussed in 2024. And again, it was one of the recommendations out of the misclassification task force that included the Department of Revenue, the Department of Labor, the Department of Economic Deed. And one of the things, and again, I just, to bring us back to the conversation that, you know, I see some members from some of my fellow members on the Fraud Prevention and Government Oversight Committee, who we talk about the real problem when entities, when organizations, when people defraud the state and our public programs. And misclassification fraud is fraud, and it is fraud that affects specifically our unemployment trust fund. It affects tax revenue that's not available for things like the bill we heard right before this, things like the projects and programs that affect folks in our communities. And then I think that I just want to highlight what Mr. Johnson said, because when we talk about this too, it is also a real problem for those businesses that are following the law, following the employment law, paying their taxes, and having to compete against companies and individuals and employers who don't. And it just doesn't pencil out. I have heard that more and more, and if you're in the Workforce Committee, you would have heard that a lot. And so what this bill, again, is about is saying that we shouldn't have in our tax code a federal provision, which we incorporated unintentionally. It hasn't been decades. It's been 17 years since 2009. For the years between 1979 and 2009, we did not have this provision. And we still saw the world that turned and businesses opened and they followed the law, but or didn't. But importantly, what we are talking about here is our state and federal agencies, but particularly in this case our state agencies, having the ability to go after the folks who have misclassified their workers. And one of the things that's important, and since I have the time to say this, that in this provision is this allows you to continue to misclassify your workers, even if you are found to have violated the IRS law. And so, again, I think I would hope that, you know, this was in the bill in 2024. I think that there has been a lot of conversation and a lot more conversation, both about the issue of misclassification fraud and more generally about the public programs fraud, that this is one of the things that fits into that. And I would hope that we would have a bipartisan consensus in saying that we want to make sure our laws are as strongly as possible, our enforcers have what they need. And if you break the law, you should not find a safe haven, even if, you know, you're up here defending that because it works for some of your members. We hear all the time, our job is not to represent any employer or any business. Our job is to represent the people of Minnesota who rely on these important programs and revenue streams, and they also rely on us ensuring that people who cheat them and defraud them are held accountable. And that's what this bill does. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1183, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the 2026 tax bill, and it is laid over. Chair Davids.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. I'll get in tomorrow in a second, but I was remiss yesterday. I had my Fillmore County bill, and Mr. Swanson put a lot of time into that bill, and I just want to thank him. And members, you know that we have a tremendous partisan and nonpartisan research staff, but I want to thank Jared and the whole crew for all that you do for us and will continue to do throughout the rest of the session as we come together. So with that, members, if you look at the back of your agenda for today, the bills listed for tomorrow are on the back of the agenda. I won't go through them all. There's quite a few, a lot of local option sales tax and so forth. So that's what we'll be working on tomorrow. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There being no further business in front of the committee, we are adjourned.